All right. Well, today we begin our discussion on the social contract, also called the social compact, by Jean-Jacques Rousseau. When I say Jean-Jacques Rousseau, I would like everyone in the class to go, like you're shuddering, like you just heard the name of he who shall not be named, because he's worse than Voldemort, honestly. Jean-Jacques Rousseau. He's terrible, literally terrible, a terrible human. One of his contemporaries was named Voltaire, and but Jean-Jacques Rousseau looked way worse than that, creepier than that even. His contemporary Voltaire might be the only person worse than him, but Jean-Jacques Rousseau is the author of The Social Contract, and that's what we will be studying next. And it's going to be interesting because, you know, we're going chronologically. We started with Pilgrim's Progress, then we moved to the Plymouth Plantation and the Pilgrims heading over to the United States, or to, you know, what was the United States land at that time. And now we're moving into the 1700s and what is called the Enlightenment period with a man by the name of Jean-Jacques Rousseau. And it's going to be interesting because you're going to see such a massive change from the time of the Pilgrims. And the heart of the Pilgrims and the writings of the Pilgrims and the heart and the times and the writing of Jean-Jacques Rousseau. It's as if the West began its apostasy right around that particular time period. You know, of course, you had the Reformation in the 1500s, right? You had men like Bunyan writing Pilgrim's Progress, godly men writing profound works. And then you have the Pilgrims, and then you have these debauched heathens, like Rousseau and Voltaire and Hume and Kant and others. And so, yes, question right in the middle of the lecture. Yes?
Is he the reason why half the population just totally forgot about the Bible?
He is part of the reason. He is part of the reason. Voltaire, his contemporary, actually said that the Bible would be extinct in about 100 years. And the legend goes that Voltaire's house was turned into a museum for the Bible. And actually, Voltaire is becoming increasingly extinct. So, but let's just think about the contract with the Pilgrims. They made up a government on the way to the Mayflower. What was it called? The Mayflower Compact. Now, here we have the Social Compact. Social Compact. You know, these are other names for covenants, but usually we use the word covenant to describe an agreement between men and God. When you name a covenant a contract, it gives the impression that the agreement is no longer between God, but just an agreement between men, right? Now, that's kind of what the connotation of those words. If I were to say we sign a contract, would you think that God was involved? No. Not usually. You would think it was just a business contract. But in reality, the Bible teaches that contracts are types of covenants. And that God is involved. God expects you to keep your promises, right? Right? Mm-hmm. So the Mayflower Compact versus the Social Contract. And you remember the famous painting of the Pilgrims? What was at the center of their life and the center of their covenant?
The Bible.
The Bible, the Word of God. Why did they want to come to the New World? Primarily because of worship. They were being forced to kneel to the Eucharist. The government was involved in their worship. Well, with Rousseau, you're going to see a man that believes the government should be involved with everything. Right? Yes, liberals. Rousseau is one of the fathers of modern-day liberalism. Rousseau is like their John Bunyan. He's like their Martin Luther. Right? You're going to see the Pilgrims, though, looking forward to the New World to lay a foundation for the gospel and believing in the promise and the progress and the triumph of the gospel over the whole world, right? Remember, they were, what do you call that eschatological position? They were post-millennial, that's right. But with Rousseau, he's going to, at least early in his life, he changes his mind a little bit, but early in his life, he believes that primitive man, like living alone in the forest with no progress, no society, no civilization, he believed that man is the most moral. That's kind of where the myth of the moral, perfectly pure and clean Indians come from. That's absolutely false. We know that men are born depraved, right? Whether there's one of them or a million of them, depravity reigns without Christ. You see, with the pilgrims, what do they care about most? They care about their family and they care about their church, right? The church is, in fact, made up of a collection of families. The pilgrims were a church. Did they believe in government? Yes, they had a governor. They even executed a man once, and they banished people for just reasons. They believed in the church, the family, and the state. Why did they believe in all three spheres? Because God ordains all three spheres, and all three spheres have officers that are ministers of Christ within those spheres, right? You call them pastors, you call them governors, magistrates, parents, etc. Well, Rousseau doesn't hardly believe in the family at all. He's not what you would call a family man. He's a degenerate. And he certainly doesn't believe in the church. He writes this entire book called The Social Contract, discussing what the just foundation of a society would be. And guess who he leaves out?
God.
So is it going to be just? No. It's actually his thoughts and his philosophical writings are going to be the foundation of the tyranny that emerges later with the French Revolution, Karl Marx and the communists, Stalin, Lenin, Adolf Hitler. These people are the birth children of Jean-Jacques Rousseau, Hillary Clinton, etc. Right. So, the major question in this book, The Social Contract, is this. How can we justly come to just decisions as a nation? 150 million people. Why should we listen to the police, or to the mayor, or the sheriff, or the governor, or the president, or the legislative body? Why should we abide by the Constitution? Should we abide by the Constitution? What do you think?
Yes.
What would the pilgrims say?
Yeah.
They would say it's a covenant. When their children were born, when the pilgrims' children were born, they were born under the jurisdiction and the covenant of the Mayflower Compact, weren't they? Because the pilgrims believed in a biblical tradition of what's called covenant succession, that you can be born into your family's covenant, church covenant, and civil covenant with the government. Right? That's why we believe in the Constitution, right? That's why we want to know, what does the Constitution say? But is everyone in our country like that? Does everyone care about what the Constitution says? No, our quote-unquote Supreme Court actually found, quote-unquote, the right to murder an unborn baby in the Constitution. Now, we're going to be reading the Constitution next. We're going to, after we leave the social contract, we're going to be reading the Constitution, the Declaration of Independence. But can you guess, before we read it, if abortion is in it?
No.
Of course not. It's absurd, right? Do you think they care about the amendments like the right to free worship and the right to bear arms and the right of free speech? Do you think they care about those things? No, because they don't believe in covenant. They don't believe that we are under the Constitution as a covenant because they don't believe in God who established that covenant with us. All right? See, that all comes from Rousseau. Rousseau is asking the question, why should we follow the Constitution? Why should we listen to the king? But he's not answering it with God in mind at all. And he doesn't have the covenantal worldview that the pilgrims had. He doesn't believe that he or anyone else is born into any sort of a covenant. Make sense? So let's try to anticipate what Rousseau is going to say in this book. Right? Let's try to anticipate it. Imagine a world where there's no God, right? John Lennon sang this song. Imagine there's no heaven. You know the song? Imagine there's no heaven. You know the song? It's easy if you try. No, he says it's easy if you try. You see, in a world, though, where there's no heaven, no God, does that mean there's no God on earth? Or does God then come down to earth? Like, if God's not in charge, who's next in line? Humans.
Or the devil.
Man. Well, the devil, for sure. You in covenant with God or covenant with the devil. But the devil's invisible, too, to people like that. And so, if God's not in charge, who do they think is in charge? Is it the parakeets and the gophers? No. It's man. Right?
Right.
But is it this man or that man?
These men.
It's these men.
You can say.
It's what we call collective man. Man coming together. And how does man come together? But a social contract. Not a covenant between God and man, written according to his law, right? But a social contract. Man comes together and forms a
government.
A government. That's right. And then that government is to be governed, quote unquote, by the will of God, or the will of whom?
God.
Should it be governed by God? Yes. But in this world, remember, we're imagining there's no God, no heaven. This new government they've come together to form, because remember, there's no God, right? Is going to be ruled according to might, is what. That's interesting. You're going to see that in book one, in the first few chapters. He says, why should we listen to the king? What's the difference between us and the king? He says, well, the king's stronger. He'll kill you if you don't. So should you listen if you want to live? But is that just? Is that just? No. Does might make right? Because the master has more power than the slave, the master is therefore justified? No, not at all. You see, he's trying to figure out, how can you have a just society with no God? And do you think he's going to be successful?
No.
How can you even have justice without a God? How can you even have righteousness or good or bad or any of those things? Right? If you don't get it from the Bible, where are you going to get it from? Right? Where are you going to get your moral standards from if you don't get it from the Bible? Are you going to get it from nature?
No.
Animals murder each other all the time. They murder and rape, et cetera, et cetera. It's not wrong for them. But if we just looked at nature, we're not coming up with a moral standard, are we? At least not well. Right? See, his task is, in this book, impossible. But he's going to try it, and he's going to write a lot of things, and people are going to listen to him. And he's going to make the world a much worse place as a result of it, unfortunately. How many people died under Stalin following much of what Karl Marx taught? Who followed what Rousseau taught? 100-something million people. That's right. Millions and millions. Right. So that's the major question of this book. How can we come to just decisions as a society? We need a social contract. And the government will lead us according to the will, not of God, but of the new God, collective man. What he's going to call something along the lines of the general will. What we might call today popular opinion or something like that. All right. So you could think about it like this. If you and your friends are trying to decide what game to play out at recess, how do you decide?
Vote.
You could have a vote. So then the majority wins. So the majority is God. That's the God of Demos. Demos, the God of democracy. But is Demos just? What if the majority decide to play the game, beat the minority, right, with sticks? Well, Demos ruled. The general will says it's good. Into the cattle carts you go and off to the concentration camp. The majority voted. Right, you see the problems we have when you get rid of God. You have no idea how to run a society any longer. Right? So, and Christians that say this sort of stuff today are looked at as crazy. Right? We say, no, we should listen to the Constitution, to the actual words of it, because that's the covenant we're in. And when the president breaks the Constitution, we say we don't have to obey the president. When the governor breaks the Constitution, we don't have to obey the governor, because he's supposed to obey the Constitution. That's the covenant we're in. That was established under God with us that we were born into. So we keep that covenant. They're the breakers of the covenant, and we don't listen to them. But if we say that, we're called all sorts of names, even by Christians sometimes. All right. So if you really want to understand this book, you got to understand Rousseau himself. Let's take some notes on this. He's born in Geneva, Switzerland, which really gets under my skin. This is the worst thing about him, is that he's born in Geneva, Switzerland. How terrible is that?
Pretty bad.
Does anyone know why that's so bad?
No, John Calvin's from there.
That's where John Calvin ministered. He's not from there. He's from France. But
wow.
He ministered there in Geneva. No.
What?
Not the famous city of Reformation. or John Calvin and John Knox and John Fox and all of those others we're going to read about later from. John Fox, of Fox's Book of Martyrs. That's right. He was there in Calvin's church, along with John Knox, who came over and evangelized the Scottish people, of which I'm a part of. So Geneva, and he was born in 1712, not long after the settlement in Plymouth Plantation. And he's born in a period, early in the period, called the Enlightenment. All right, the Enlightenment. Now, when you hear of a time period called the Enlightenment, what could you deduce from that?
That's amazing.
Ooh, the world is seeing a great light. The light of secularism. The light of collective man and his will and his wisdom. The light of Rousseau and other idiots like him. Enlightenment. But what does that imply about the time period before the Enlightenment?
The Dark Ages.
The Dark Ages, yes. What we call Christendom, what we call the rule of Christ over the West, not perfect, but definitely better than what the Romans had. If you know anything about, well, y'all know a lot about the Romans because you read about that. Lots of murder and rape and all sorts of horrific things, and genocide, etc. Christendom had emerged, right? If we want to say that Christendom started with the conversion of Constantine, you know, that's fair. And then in the 1700s, we began to see what secular philosophers, what your typical college professor would call the Enlightenment. You see, because in their mind, the world had gone dark. Rome was at the height, and it was beautiful and majestic, and they built aqueducts. Ooh, aqueducts, right? In reality, Rome just copied the Greeks, just to be honest with you. We think about the Roman roads, so majestic. The roads were tiny and small. And you know why they built them? So that they could go all over the place and steal taxes from everyone. That's why they built them. You couldn't even walk on the roads. You would break your ankle. You had to walk on the grass on the side of the road. We think of Rome as this massive and beautiful and powerful place. All they had, they got from the Greeks. Right? So Rome was a terrible time, a time of genocide and slavery. There were more slaves during that time than any other time in the planet, based on my reading. So then Christendom emerges, and Christians are, entire tribes are becoming Christian. And you begin to see the concept of justice for the very first time, like biblical justice and peace. And you see the conversion of the Goths and the conversion of the Anglo-Saxons and all this great and wonderful stuff. You see innovations in the Middle Ages. Like stirrups, that was a really good one. Or the the horse plow. You know, that was a great invention. And the water wheel. Like if, in your mind, if you think of a medieval town, you think of like a little water mill going through a stream, right? Mm-hmm. And the little market and all of that. So many amazing inventions took place in the Middle Ages. It's because Christianity was ruling, and there's a lot of cool books that teach about that. But then what they decided is, you know what, we need to bring back the teachings of Aristotle and Plato so that we could have light again. You see, Aristotle and Plato, who was God for them?
Themselves.
Man. That's called humanism. The Enlightenment was really the rebirth of humanism in Western civilization. And of course, humanists call it the Enlightenment. We would call it the Endarkenment, if that were a word. We could put it another way. We could say they were getting woke, right? Light was dawning. They're finally awakening to their true potential. And that's when Rousseau was born. And Rousseau is going to contribute to this quote-unquote enlightenment. He was a philosopher, a scientist, a musician. You could be all of those things back then because the fields of study didn't involve too much. They're super smart. He was super smart, like an incredible writer. Like very, very gifted. But today you can't be a musician and a scientist. There's just too much information to master because the fields have expanded so far. Right? You kind of have to pick what God wants you to do with your life. You don't get to do everything, right? So, but he did all sorts of things. He was a writer, philosopher, etc. He was a depraved person, as I mentioned, He tells stories of how he began stealing at a young age and continued to steal often. His friend bought him a ticket to the opera, and when the lights went down and the play began, he snuck out the back door and returned the ticket and took the money and went off and spent it how he wanted. So that's just one story he tells in some of his works. Some of the things he writes are kind of funny, kind of witty, sarcastic. He was a law unto himself, as you can imagine. He was certainly not concerned about Christ's law over him. And do you think someone like that would be able to write a good and just political theory?
Yeah.
Does character matter in politics? Yeah. If you're going to be a governor, does it matter what your character is like? Absolutely it does, right? And so, quick overview of the book and then we'll be done. It's got four books within the book, which is confusing. What we call chapters, when you look at your little link, they're called books. But, you know, it doesn't really matter what you call them, right? So it's one book with four books, four chapters. In book one, Rousseau is going to try to find some principle that unites everything. A principle that we could say, based on this, this is how we establish a good society. And of course, if you don't have Christ, can you do that? No. You know, Christ is the one person. He is the king. He is upon the throne. And he is over all of life, right? Mm-hmm. He is over the family, he is over the church, and he is over the state, right? Now watch this, look at this. Christ is in heaven on the throne, and his authority reigns over all of earth, over the family, over the church, and over the state. The three institutions that God has ordained and created in the world. When did he create the family? Genesis 1. When did he create the government? Nine-ish, right after the flood, right? Good, good. And when did he create the church? Ooh. Hard to say when, because it was before time was even began, right? In the mind of God, the elect were in his mind, right? So when did he create the church? Well, you know, eternally. Let's say eternally, right? And of course, he launches the New Testament church at Pentecost. So the king, Jesus, is over all of those. How should the church operate? According to the laws of Jesus. How should the state operate? According to the laws of Jesus. In Romans 13, the ministers of the state, the governors, are called ministers of Christ. Diakonos. Christos. Who knows what diakonos means?
Minister.
That's right. Ministers of Christ. Deacons. And the family is to operate according to the laws of Christ. Right? What does Jesus say about disciplining children? If they disobey, then what should happen to them? That's right. Spare the rod, spoil the child. The Bible has a lot to say about family, church, and state, and all family, church, and state gets their meaning, their significance, and their guide for life from King Jesus. He's the one, now listen to this, this is an important point, he's the one who oversees and gives meaning to the many, okay? So you got the one, and you have the many. What makes your job, once you accomplish your job or your schooling, have any meaning? Is it football? Is that the one in the many?
No.
What gives football? Is it career? Is it
worldview?
No. What is the only thing that can truly give your life meaning and purpose? Like, why do you do this? Why do you do that? The answer is the kingdom, which is another way of saying the king. Christ and his purposes, Christ and his rule, Christ and his kingdom. Your life has no meaning if it's not connected to the one who is Christ. Understand what I mean? If you remove Christ, all you have is the many. And the many no longer have purpose or meaning. They have to discover their own meaning, my own dream, right? My own destiny. You know, this is important to me, okay? But the question is it important in reality? Does it have meaning in Christ? So remember the famous painting you studied a few years back where Plato and Aristotle are pictured. And Plato, remember, has a one finger pointing up. Who remembers studying that painting? It was years ago. Y'all remember that? Mm-hmm. See, Plato's philosophy focused on the unity, the one. Okay? Aristotle had two fingers pointing down to earth. He focused on the many, the particulars. He said, you know, meaning can be found in the particulars. And Plato said, no, meaning is found in the one. And Jesus says it's one and many. Right? Trinity. Right? I know that's some heavy philosophy for you, but when you go to university, what two words make up the word university?
One.
Unity, diversity, one and many. That's where the concept of a university comes from, because you're going to study a diversity of subjects, right? What are some of the subjects you study?
Science,
math, geometry, etc. Right? Gender studies. No, God forbid. Right? You study all these diverse subjects, but what gives the one the meaning over all of these? What makes it a university? Christ. And that's why Christians establish universities. That's why all the old universities have Christian mottos and Christian crests. But if you take Christ out of the university, what do you have?
Diversity.
You have a diversity. Right? But now, let me see if y'all can get at least this philosophy on a basic level. What is the words that make up the universe?
Uni.
Uni and diversity, same thing. So all the many particulars in this universe, you, animals, plants, air, time, water, rivers, all of these diversities, these many. In the universe, they have meaning because they are integrated into the one who is Christ. That's right. He's a person, Christ, and he's God. What if we take God out of the universe? What do you have?
You have chance.
Yes, that's exactly right. You have chance. You have evolution. You have diversity only. But here's the thing. When you have only diversity, you lose meaning, right? You lose meaning. You lose morality. You lose justice. You lose any trueness. So you have to create something new. I'll give you a clue. Marvel. How do they try and create meaning without God?
Justice.
No, think about it. They don't have a universe. They have a multiverse. Interesting. A diversity. Isn't that something? You see what they're doing there? It's a new way of fashioning meaning and significance. You have a multiverse. Now we have absolute chance. Chance. Diversity. The many, not the one. See, Rousseau's trying to make significance of the many, but he doesn't have the one. He's trying to build a government and a society that's just and has meaning and is right and true, but with no Christ. It's an impossible mission, right? And so he has to create a new God. And you're going to see in book two that he names the new God, capital G, General Will. Isn't that an interesting word? We've been studying the Westminster Confession, and the word will comes up a lot, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. What rules the universe?
God's will.
Preordained before time. But in Rousseau's world, what runs the universe? Mm-hmm. Or what runs his verse? His, right? He doesn't have a uni. What runs it? Not God's will, general will, which is another way of saying man's will. Collective man's will. Now think about that, guys. If collective man comes together with a social contract and is now God, and God determines right, doesn't he? God determines what's right and true and just. Do you see how that becomes the birthplace, the foundational teachings for why Hitler can massacre millions of people? Because the government says so. Because the majority votes it in. You see what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Abortion is right because, hey, the Supreme Court said so. They're the Supreme, capital S, court. But they're not, are they? Jesus is the Supreme Judge. Right? That's the difference. So he creates this concept, or he really rebirths it from Aristotle and Plato, of the general will, the new sovereign. It's not a king, it's collective man coming together in what we call today the state, right, or the civil government. And then in book three, he looks into what society, following the general will of the, quote, people, should look like. Would you like a society built on the, quote, general will? Why not? Because the general will is generally foolish, naive. You want to be ruled by duffel puds? Yes, 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 yes. Right? For those of you who read Narnia. No, you want to be ruled by, according to God's law. All right. When God established a government in the Bible, what was the rule over it?
The Bible.
The Bible. God's law. When they asked for a king like all the other nations, remember that story? God gave them Saul. He didn't give them a king like all the other nations. They wanted it. He gave them Saul, but Saul had Samuel, and Samuel wrote a constitution, and he kept it, and he taught Saul it, and Saul had to rule according to that constitution. Saul wasn't the God. The people's vote wasn't the God. Right? God was the God. That's right. And then in book four, he gives just practical issues on how to run this sort of a government. So what you're going to be reading about is a man who theorizes the formation of a new government and a new society ruled no longer by covenant like the Mayflower Compact, no longer by God, but by the will of collective man. And that is the war that we're still fighting to this day. The war between, the faithful in America that want to make America Christian again, and the secularists, is really a war between Rousseau and the Pilgrims. It's the same battle. Covenant versus contract. You see what I'm saying? All right. Were y'all able to follow all of that, or most of it, some of it? All right. I see some heads shaking yes and some not so sure. Jackson has his usual pose. All right. All right. Well, that's it for today. Is it time for lunch yet?
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Getting close. All right.